The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good evening, everybody. I'm awfully happy to be sitting with you tonight and just a chance to share a little bit about what's been going on for me right now. Earlier today, it was very oppressive and close in the air, humid, and we had this wild shower, downpour, which was, you know, spectacular. And then it ended, and it wasn't any less oppressive or close around here. But while we were sitting, I heard some geese flying, and we're having fall. And I don't know if anybody here is from the West Coast, because I don't know all of you. But I also just am very aware that the experience I'm having here is not the same experience other people are having. You know, I'm sure you have your own environment in New York. And then, of course, the people that are out in Washington and Oregon, California are having something else altogether. And if we broaden it beyond that, you know, there's people all around the world having their own experience. So here we are sitting together. We're all having our experience, different experiences, but we're doing it together in this fashion. So part of what we're doing together, I think, is just learning to pay attention. And for me, one of the things I've been paying attention to has been this whole conversation around race. And in particular, what's resonated for me on a personal level has been this question of unconscious bias. And I actually, so I've been thinking about, you know, what's going on in my unconscious? You know, what are the things that I'm not even aware of that might be influencing me or affecting me? And, you know, when I practice, I can see that I have my own reactions, right? Sometimes I feel sad or sometimes I feel angry. And the practice of sitting for me is starting to explore, you know, what's going on, noticing it, letting it go, and also asking questions about it. What is happening for me? So I believe that the process of exploring what's going on in our unconscious is really a part of Zen training. I'm not sure that's been the traditional interpretation, but for me, that's been a big piece of it. You know, Dogen, of course, says to study the way is to study the self. And what he's asking us to do is to say, well, what is the self? You know, what are all the personal ingredients that make up the self? And then what is it that causes the self to feel separate? And a lot of what we do, or what I've needed to do, has been to explore that personal history. But also realizing that a lot of my personal history isn't unique to me. So I have my own stories from my childhood, things that happened. But there are collective stories that have happened to most of us, or that even if they didn't happen to us, became part of our shared understanding of who we are as a society or as a member of society. And these aren't always as easy to see in my experience. And it takes sometimes like an extra external thing that can make me suddenly look at it in a different way and realize that I have something going on that I wasn't even aware of. And I feel that this is of utmost importance, because we don't only need to wake up as individuals, we need to wake up as a civilization. We have problems of racism, but we have problems of our economy. We have problems of the climate, problems of species extinction, overpopulation, deforestation. I could go on. And just like we have biases around the issue of racism, I am convinced that we have biases that are feeding into or created by or help create some of these other problems. So I wanted to share with you a couple of stories where I saw some old events that happened in a new kind of way that I think grew out of my thinking about these things and noticing these things. So the background to this is, it was many years ago, and my partner and I were traveling for a number of months in India and Nepal. And it was a very interesting, challenging trip that I've thought about in various ways since then. I've seen how some of my reactions and some of the things that I responded to really grew up out of my personal history, why I liked things that I liked or didn't like, what I didn't like, what was easy, what was hard. Just a lot, seeing how my personality emerged in a different kind of way in this very new environment. So in this particular story, the first one I'm going to tell you took place in the northern part of India that's actually on the Tibetan Plateau. And it's an area called Ladakh. And the people that live there are Tibetan Buddhists, originally from Tibet, but they've been part of India now for a long time. But it's a Buddhist area. And to make a long story short, my partner and I found ourselves in the position where we could have a private interview with a Rinpoche. Now, a Rinpoche, if you don't know, is a reincarnated master. And so they are typically discovered as a reincarnated being very early. You know, maybe they're only 2 or 3 years old, and they spend their whole life in training and as Zen monk, not Zen, well, Tibetan Buddhist monks, and that's how they live, and so you can say that this is a person that has practiced, not exactly our style of practice, but they practice for a very, very long time. And so in this visit, we sat with him while he was getting ready to leave the village that we were in. And so he was sitting at a long, low table and having a bowl of soup and peppering us with questions about who we were. And he was just curious about us. There was no particular purpose to this meeting. And we asked him some questions about who he was and where he came from. And while we were talking, in comes another person, a villager, I suppose. And they have something to give to the Rinpoche. So he puts aside his bowl of soup and then reaches under the table where he brings up a leather suitcase. He undoes the straps. He takes his key. He unlocks it. He releases the locks, opens it up, takes out the first layer of clothing, takes out the second layer of clothing, takes the document that this person gave him, puts them in the suitcase, then puts back the second layer, puts back the first layer, closes the suitcase, does the locks, does the straps, puts the whole thing under the table, proceeds to thank the person, they say goodbye, person leaves, starts to heat his soup again. No sooner does he lift the spoon to his mouth, the door opens, somebody else comes in. She also has something she needs to give. So takes this moves the bowl, takes the suitcase, puts it on the table, undoes the straps, opens it up, does the key, the lock, taking everything out, one, two, takes the document, puts it in there, and then reverses the whole thing. First layer, second layer, close the lid, close the locks, put the strap on, take the thing underneath. And then seat is soaked. And another minute, the door opens yet again. In comes another person, also with something to give him. He starts to take the suitcase out, put it on the table, and my partner just kind of bursts out what we both were thinking and says, "That's the third time you've had to open your suitcase." And the Rinpoche looks at us and he says, "You're counting?" So I remembered this story for a long time because up until that point, it had never occurred to me that it might be possible to not count, you know, just to kind of go through whatever it is that you were working on and needed to be done and not thinking, is this the first time? Is this the second time? Am I almost done? Am I just beginning? How's it going? You know? And that is, in fact, very much part of my experience, I think, as a person, you know? There's always a before and after, and now and then, one and many, big and small, whole series of comparisons, measuring, noting how things fit in relationship to the things that have come before, the things that are going after. But the interesting thing is that just recently, as I mentioned to you, I've been thinking about this question of unconscious biases. It occurred to me that there was actually another layer to this story that I had never noticed before. And that's the layer that says, why do I think there's a problem with opening the suitcase three times? What's the assumption that if you had just been more efficient, left the suitcase out until it was all done, that that would actually be a better way of doing it? And so I realized that I had a series of kind of judgments and assumptions about this behavior that had never occurred to me to notice before. So I have another story also from this trip that kind of looks at this also. The thing that's interesting about this story is I actually had forgotten it. And it was only after I thought about this story with the Rinpoche that then I realized, actually, I had this experience a second time, and it goes like this. I'm staying in Nepal with an American woman and her Nepalese husband, and they run a tourist hotel, and it was off season, it was the monsoon, and so we got to stay there with her and him, you know, just as guests. And so I got to see her life up close. And as part of her running this enterprise, you know, she did all the cooking. And it's Nepal. And so cooking typically involves a lot of rice. And so she made rice, fresh rice, several times a day. And I was watching her do this one day. And she has a big container of rice. And then she would take a large, very beautiful, very large woven basket with a shallow side. And she would scoop out the amount of rice that she needed for this meal. And then a series of kind of undulating, gentle shaking motions, the rice would sort of sift. And the parts of the rice that were good to eat would separate out from the pieces of twig and dirt and whatever that you don't want to eat. And it took a little while, and she would do this before each cooking of rice. And I remember sitting with her and saying, you know, do you do this before, do you have to do this every time you cook rice? You know, it seemed kind of labor intensive to me. And she said, yes, you know. And I remember I had the thought, but I'd forgotten about this. I had the thought, why wouldn't she just do a whole batch of rice at once so she didn't have to do this every single time? You know, wouldn't it be much more effective and, you know, efficient if she could just, like, prep her rice ahead of time and then she wouldn't have to do it? And so, you know, that actually has a series of assumptions under it, too. Right? What are they? Sifting rice is a chore. It's not the main activity. Main activity is either cooking the rice or, better yet, eating the rice. Chores are something to get through, right? They're not something you should spend time, any more time on than you absolutely have to. They're kind of a necessary annoyance. The fruits of our labor are in the product, right? It's nothing to do with this activity of sifting. It's only in that cooked rice. And it's therefore desirable to find a way to be as efficient as we can so that we can do more of whatever it is that we've decided is the good fruit of our labor, either in quantity or quality. And I want to tell you, I mean, those are kind of like primitive thoughts of mine, but frankly, there's more days than one when my partner will say to me at the end of the day, how was your day? And I'll say, it's good, I got a lot done, you know, or not so good, I could barely get anything done. And so the measurement of my day has become, what did I check off my list? How much did I get done? Was I effective today or not? So I want to share a koan with you that looks at this in a slightly different way. It's called Ching Ching's Sound of Raindrops. Ching Ching asked a monk, what is that outside the gate? The monk said, the sound of raindrops. Ching said, sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. The monk said, what about you, teacher? Ching said, I almost don't lose myself. The monk said, what is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself? Ching said, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. So this is one of those cones that I find I can keep coming back to and can be looked at in a number of different ways. But in terms of these stories I've been telling you, I think it's asking the question, what is it that prevents us from being able to directly experience the moment, the opening the spirit, the suitcase, the sifting the rice? We lose ourselves. Well, first of all, what is that self that gets lost? We have a self that can experience the raindrop that doesn't have to categorize it, doesn't have to name it, just can experience it. But when we follow after things, we lose ourselves. We start grasping at explanations and reason and logic, opinions, regimens, judgments. What does it mean to almost not lose oneself? I wonder about that. I wonder if maybe the Rinpoche was counting too. When we function, we actually have to count, right? If you want to make a train, you need to know what time it is. If you need to get a project done, you need to know how long you have and how many steps are involved in the process. And yet, at the same time, how can we do that without losing our direct experience of the moment? How do we express that? At the moment that we express, there actually has to be some kind of separation from the experience. another way of looking at it is there's always more in the unconscious. You know, how much, no matter how much we uncover, no matter how much we explore, no matter how much we understand, there's still more there. And that more there can be known, but maybe it can't all be expressed. Some of our instincts help us to survive, as I said, but some of them don't help us. Some of them are old leftovers or just were never a good idea in the first place. But I don't actually think that the problem is that we have things that are unconscious. I think that we have suffering or cause suffering when those unconscious parts of our nature become somehow matters of principle. We become attached to them without even knowing that they're there. It's when they become biases. Biases like racism or xenophobia, homophobia, sexism. We believe in what we think. We believe that virtue and thrift and efficiency are signs of superiority or the requirements of being a good person. Listen to these words from Benjamin Franklin. This is our cultural heritage. Haste makes waste. Lost time is never found again. No gains without pains. A penny saved is a penny earned. For every minute spent in organizing, an hour is earned. The way to wealth is as plain as the way to market. It depends chiefly on two words, industry and frugality. That is, waste neither time nor money, but make the best use of both. Without industry and frugality, nothing will do, and with them, everything. So how much of this do you think we've absorbed as a civilization? And do you think that any of these thoughts that may be part of our unconscious right now are actually causing some of the problems that we're experiencing in our society with the environment or with the economy? Do any of these inform your actions and beliefs without you ever having said, oh, yes, I actually agree with this? Do you think they're true? Really? So our task of paying attention is never ending. Our consciousness is boundless, and so is our unconsciousness. That's why I almost don't lose myself. And still, we need to express. Oh, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. So I don't want to end with Benjamin Franklin. I'm going to end with one small expression by Jack Kerouac. The rain has filled the birdbath again, almost.